So first of all, I would like to thank you really for the opportunity of giving this talk today. And I also want to thank everyone for joining the presentation. And today I want to talk about two groups. So I know that probably many of you are not that familiar with these mathematical objects. So we spend some time on the motivation of why I want to on the description of introduction on this object, these two groups, and why we really need them for describing a model of four-dimensional gravity, dimensional geometries. In particular, see, this is the topic that I want to discuss today, and I want to focus on the fact that GR can be formulated as a constrained topological model in four dimensions, either with or without the cosmological constant. And in particular, this idea led to the formulation of quantum gravity as a and quantum gravity and quantum geometry also as a state sum model. So this is the idea that I want to discuss today. So a state sum model of discrete curved geometries. So for curved geometries, I mean geometries that also include the cosmological constant. And I want to discuss what are the aspects that we do expect in quantum gravity in four dimensions in this type of model, and how we can include this type of features of the model. First of all, before going through the four-dimensional model, let's see what happened in three dimensions, where gravity here is a topological model, so it's naturally described by a BF theory at a classical level, eventually also with the inclusion of a cosmological constant with a further term. So in this case, the fundamental fields are the connection and a triad. They are both one forms. And in particular, if you want to describe Euclidean 3D gravity, then the connection has to be a one form with values in the Lie algebra of SU2. Whereas if you also want to include the cosmological constant in the classical action, then the triad has to be a one form with values in the Lie algebra of AN2, where this algebra explicitly depends on this cosmological constant. Now, this is the classical picture. If you want to quantize it, we first have to go through the discretization pattern. And for discretization, I mean that we really want to interpret this connection and the triad as the configuration and momentum variables. Okay, now we want to describe a pair of discrete cellular decompositions dual each other. So in particular, I'm going to talk about a triangulation and its dual complex. We will interpret them as our discrete configuration and momentum spaces. Okay, and the proper way to include the cosmological constant in this case, which means that the proper way to have both the configuration and momentum space to be curved, okay, is using the Poisson-Lie groups. So in particular, we will consider we can interpret the Poisson-Lie group SU2 as our configuration space, and the Poisson-Lie group AN2 as a momentum space, for instance. Okay, and when we say we discretize the model, it means that since both the fields are one forms, we are gonna attach this object, so the group element of the Poisson-Lie group SU2 and the group element of the Poisson-Lie group AN2 to one-dimensional object. Okay, so because these are one form, so they have a natural interpretation as a one-dimensional object, either in the triangulation or in the dual complex, which are our configuration and momentum spaces, okay, discrete ones. So in particular, the usual discretization pattern is when we discretize the triad on the edges of a triangulation and the connection on the links of a dual complex. Okay, so it means that we put, for instance, the elements of the group of the Poisson-Lie group AN2 on we use this element as decorations of the edges. Okay, and the element of SU2 as decorations of the links. So this is the usual choice that we make, for instance, in IQG, whereas the other way around, when we discretize the triads on the link and the connection on the edges, is what is known in literature as dual IQG. So this is the discrete picture. Now, if we go through the quantum model, then we quantize this idea, we quantize these Poisson-Lie groups, and the quantum version of them is known as quantum groups, which are objects that are really able to encode the quantum state of discrete curved geometry. So they actually encode the cosmological constant the cosmological constant, and we use the elements of these quantum groups now as a decoration of our dual cellular decompositions, so triangulation and dual complex. So this is very, very roughly what happened in the three-dimensional quantum gravity. Now, we would like to go through the same pattern, so from the classical action to the discrete version to the quantum case, also in four dimensions. But before doing that, I want to stress a few points, a few aspects of the three-dimensional theory that I also expect to find in the four-dimensional one. In particular, I want to stress these three features. So the fact that no matter which is the discretization pattern that we consider, okay, but we always have in three dimensions some metric degrees of freedom. And for metric degrees of freedom, I mean, we always have a decoration on the one-dimensional object of our triangulation, okay, of our discrete geometry. Second aspect is that we can actually describe curved discrete geometries, as I told you, using quantum groups. And the third is that obviously if we want to describe discrete geometries, then we want to also include all the possible topological features. And in particular in 3D, I want to stress the fact that we are able to compute the curvature around a vertex. And we can do it using the holonomy, so this one-dimensional holonomy around it, okay, in order to compute this type of curvature. Now, as I said, we expect to find this type of aspects also in a four-dimensional model. In particular, as I said, we do want to have metric degrees of freedom in four dimensions. We want to be able to describe also quantum state of curved discrete geometry so that they are trying to code the cosmological constant. And from the topological point of view, now, since we are in a one dimension higher, we expect two type of curvature. So the one dimensional path of holonomies, so the one that we will call one holonomies around an edge, but also the curvature around the vertex, which is now given by, not by a one-dimensional path, but is given by this two-dimensional surface, so this polyhedron around it, dual to this vertex. And since this is a two-dimensional surface, we will naturally call this object a two-holonomy. In particular, let me stress the first point, because I know that people have been working on four-dimensional quantum gravity for years without having this type of degree of freedom. So I want to give you two arguments for this, so for which I really think that we would need this metric, these edges, degrees of freedom, also in four dimensions. First argument is explained very well in this paper from Crane and Yetter, and is the fact that if we write down a state sum model of four-dimensional discrete geometries, okay, and if we do not include the metric degrees of freedom, so if we do not decorate the one-dimensional object of our discrete geometries, then there will be some of these geometries that are degenerate. It means that we can associate a quantum state to all of these, to all the geometries, all the discrete geometries of our model. But if we do not include this type of degrees of freedom, actually different geometries will be described by the same quantum state. So this we will have this type of degeneracy. And they argue that if we instead include this type of degrees of freedom, so the decoration on the one-dimensional object, then we would solve this type of degeneracy in the state sum model. Okay, so this is the first argument for having this type of metric degrees of freedom. The second argument is very related with the second point. So with the fact that we do want to describe curved, okay, degrees of freedom. And the second argument is known as Ekman-Hilton argument, and is basically the fact that if we have a cellular decomposition, a discrete geometry, and we describe it only using decoration on the faces. So for instance, we have this type of squares and we only decorate the faces of these squares without decorating the one-dimensional object, so that without decorating the boundaries of the squares, then the group that we use as a decoration of these spaces is has to be flat. And our interpretation is that since the faces are decorated by the group has to be abelian, and our interpretation is that since the group is abelian, then the faces, so that the whole cellular decomposition is flat. So the point is that if we do not use decoration on the one-dimensional object, on the boundaries, so the metric degrees of freedom, then we cannot describe curved geometries. Okay, and one way to see the equality argument is given by this picture, which is very simple. So you take four of these squares and you want to merge them together. Okay, and you can do that in two different ways. Either you merge them vertically first, so 1, 3 to 4 together, then you glue them horizontally, or you first glue them horizontally, so 1, 2, and 3, 4, and then you glue them vertically. Obviously, you expect to have the same result in the two ways, in the two cases. And if you want to have the same result, then the variables, so the decoration, have to commute. So the group is abelian. So this is the Jack-Wellington argument, and this is the second argument for demanding that. For having edges, symmetric degrees of freedom also in four dimensions. So just keep in mind the three features that I listed for a model of discrete geometries in four dimensions. Now let's go to the discretization pattern also in four dimensions, as I explained you in 3D. So in this case, classical gravity, classical four-dimensional gravity, can be given as a constrained BF model. And here the field are a connection and the bivector, which are respectively a 1 and 2 form. So now, as before, we can pick two different discretization patterns. And since the connection is a 1 form, we naturally discretize it on the one-dimensional object of either a triangulation or a dual complex, whereas the bivector B, so the B field, is naturally discretized on the two-dimensional object of a cellular decomposition. This one on the left is the usual discretization pattern that we use, for instance, in IQG, and is that we discretize the bivectors on the faces of a triangulation and the connection on the links of a dual complex. Okay, so basically the bivectors are the decoration of the triangles of the triangulation. In this case, we clearly don't have metric degrees of freedom. Okay, so that means that first, if we write a state sum model, then it's going to be degenerate, for the argument that I told you before. And second, because of the Ekman-Hilton argument, we cannot describe curve geometries. From the topological point of view now, since we have link decoration, we can, so one holonomies, we can describe the curvature around an edge. But regarding the curvature around the vertex, which is what I told you before, so is this two-dimensional surface around the vertex, well, it's not clear whether we can actually encode this type of curvature if we only have link decoration. So you see that we might have some troubles here, whereas the alternative discretization pattern is when we discretize the connection on the edges of a triangulation and the bivector on the wedges of a dual complex. So just to fix here the notation, I'm going to use the word edges and faces for 1 and 2 dimensional objects of a triangulation, whereas links and wedges are 1 and 2 dimensional objects of the dual complex. So in this case, since we are decorating the edges, we do have metric degrees of freedom, but it's not clear whether we are actually describing curved geometries, because obviously having these edges decoration that we can describe curved edges, but we have no decoration on the faces, so they might be flat or not. We have no control on that, so it's not clear whether these geometries are curved or not. From the topological point of view, since we have these wedges, which are interpreted as the two holonomies, we can include the curvature around the vertex, but we don't have degrees of freedom around the degrees of freedom of the links, so we cannot compute the curvature around an edge. So the message here is that in both the discretization patterns that we can have in four-dimensional gravity, there might be some troubles, okay, some issues if we want to include all the features that I told you before. And the solution is that we need to have decorations on both 1 and 2 dimensional objects, so 1 and 2 holonomies in both the triangulation and in the dual complex. Okay, so we need the decoration of these four on all these four geometric objects. Now, one way to include these decorations is using two groups. So this is how and why we introduce two groups in four-dimensional quantum gravity or maybe discrete geometry. Now, one way to see two groups is the following. Consider to have a target space M, which can be interpreted as the space of the state of your model. So phi and phi prime are two different states of your model. And then in this case, you can use groups, so or group elements, holonomies, to describe, to define the transformations between the states. Okay, so this transformation are these arrows, these holonomies. Okay, so this is the transformation rule that is, and we are using like the representation of these holonomies here. Now, if we now two groups here, they are adding they add an extra layer to this picture. So we still have our target space, we still have our holonomies, which are really represented as one-dimensional path, okay, from one point to the other. So we will call them one holonomies, okay, this group element G. And we can suppose that we have two different holonomies, G and G prime, that transform the state here into another state. Okay. And now we can then introduce a further layer, so a further information, a second group element H, okay, which has the role of transforming the one holonomy G into the one holonomy G prime, okay. And you can see that this is naturally interpreted as the surface in between them. So we will call it two holonomy, okay. Now, and you can see that in this way, we really have a sort of decoration on both the one path, the one-dimensional path, okay? So this one-dimensional arrows and the surface, the two-dimensional surface. Now, this is a vague idea of how we can see two groups. Now, let's define them better. So two groups, also known as cross-module, can be seen as a pair of groups. So a group G on the one holonomies and a group H on the two holonomies, plus a pair of group homomorphisms. One is a group action, so is the action of G on H, is the action of the one holonomies on the two holonomies. The second group homomorphism is called team up. It's very important here. This is really the new information that we are inserting in the model, and is a map, and this maps the two holonomies H in the one holonomies G. And you can really see that this is used to. So this picture here is the usual way that we use for representing a two group element. Okay, and you can see that the one holonomy above and the one holonomy below, they are not independent, but they are related by this this law, okay, by this equation, which is given by the team up, so that this group of homomorphism, and they are related by the fact that there is a phase decoration in between them. Okay, now as group element can be composed then using the group product, we can also compose these two group elements, okay? And since these are more refined objects, we can compose them in two different ways, not just one. So we can compose them side by side, and we call this horizontal composition, or one on the top of the other, and we call this vertical composition. The only thing that I want to say here is that, well, there is a compatibility relation between the horizontal and the vertical composition, and this compatibility relation is the one that we use to solve the equanitan argument that I showed you before. Okay, so basically now we can consider again four of these two group elements. Okay, and we can try to glue them together. So either we glue them together first horizontally and then vertically, or first vertically and then horizontally. Now we can do this little exercise, and then since now we don't have only decorations on the faces, but we also have decoration on the one holonomies, so on the one-dimensional object. Now, using these compatibility relations, we can actually we get the same result in the two ways that we can compose these four two group elements.
Matteo, there is a question by Anna.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. I was just wondering, because you quoted a paper by John Baez, if I'm correct. I just wanted to ask whether you know whether
Sorry.
The idea. Yeah, it, exactly.
Yeah, this one.
Yeah, so that just made me wonder whether this notion of bi categories, double categories, etc., was motivated by quantum gravity, or whether like that arose out of, you know, other mathematical formalisms.
Well, historically. I've only studied that these higher categories. So in this case, we are talking about two categories.
Yeah.
I met this type of objects actually in quantum gravity. So as a tool that we need to use in four-dimensional geometries. Honestly, I don't know whether historically they have been introduced in other approaches. I'm not a mathematician, I'm not an expert of this type of thing, so I cannot tell whether they have been introduced before for some other approaches to maybe in other areas of physics or not. I met them for the first time in my life in for four-dimensional geometries, and I really suggest to maybe if you're interested to read this paper from Baez, which is very, very interesting and very pedagogical, and they explain very well why how these two groups can be defined and can be introduced and how they can be used in gravity or in four-dimensional geometry. So
sure.
Sorry.
Okay, yeah. No worries. No, I was just wondering because I remember there recently being quite a lot of debate, I think, around like the fine differences between double categories, two categories, bi-categories. And so I was just wondering whether there are similar distinctions to be made than in quantum gravity again or not, or whether that's irrelevant.
Okay. I'm
thank
sorry.
You.
And no worries. There is additionally a question or a comment by Hank.
Yeah, so this is just a comment because Anna did raise a good point about the historical motivation. I don't know what Baez, maybe it was just a pure mathematical sort of motivation, but from another field of physics, condensed matter, where people have been studying 3D topological orders, they do use two categories or these unitary fusion two categories, even though, you know, it's not very well understood what exactly they are. Usually it's because they're unitary pair. So historically there is some motivation to at least topologically using unitary braided fusion two categories to encode these topological excitations in, like, for example, lattice models and stuff like that. So
okay, thank you. So shall I go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So, okay, here I just wanted to introduce here what are two groups. And basically, if you keep in mind, this picture is enough for this slide. And what is the idea behind the definition of two groups? Now, what I try to tell you so far is that, okay, we have some type of discretization and quantization pattern in 3D. We have some features in the 3D model that we also expect in four dimensions. I told you why we expect these features. And I told you that if we want to include these features in a four-dimensional model of discrete geometries, then we need something more deeper than groups or quantum groups. In particular, we need this type of decorations of one and two holonomies in both our triangulation and the dual complex. And two groups are a possible tool to do that. And if we use two groups in this type of models, then we can include all these features that we want in our model. Now, these were my motivations. Now, what I'm going to do next is to tell you a little bit of how we can use this type of two groups in maybe not quantum gravity, but discrete geometries at least. And the first example is a project that I've been working on with Florian Girelli and one of his PhD students, Peter. And in this project, we construct the phase space of a triangulation decorated by a two group. Okay, so with decoration in both one and two holonomies. First of all, in this project, we focused on a very simplified case of two groups, which is known as skeletal two groups, which are a class of two groups where the team up is trivial. Okay, so this implies that the group of the two holonomies, okay, so the group H is abelian. Means that the faces of our two group, the faces of our discrete geometries are going to be flat. This is a strongly simplified case, I know that, but this is our starting point. And then we then next we will see how we can also use these ideas in the most general case of any for any general two group. Now, since here the team up is trivial, a skeletal two group can really be seen just a pair of groups, G and H, with a map on G of G and H. So this means that these are really the structure of what is known as semi-direct product of groups. Okay, so this is actually a group. And we can really see a skeletal two groups almost as a group. Okay, so this is the fundamental idea that we are going to use in this project. And even if this is a very simplified case of two groups, then this still includes some of the most interesting example of two groups. For instance, the Euclidean, the Poincaré two group, and you can guess why these are some of the most interesting one. Okay, for instance, I just to give you an idea, the Poincaré two group is defined as the pair of Lorentz group on the one holonomies and the group of translations, which is abelian on the two holonomies. The team up is trivial, and then the action of the one holonomies on the two holonomies is just given by the action of the Lorentz group on a four vector. Okay, so now we have this object, the skeletal two groups, which can be seen as semi-direct product of groups. Okay, and we want to describe the phase space of this object. So let's see how the phase space of a group is defined. For instance, we can think of a Lie group G, and we can see it as the configuration space of our model. And there is a natural understanding of how we can define the associated phase space, which is this cotangent bundle. And you can see that the cotangent bundle of a Lie group is given by the pair of the Lie group plus RD, where this is the dimension of G. And RD is really the vector space. So it's a flat space tangent to the group G at any point of it. Okay. And you can see that this cotangent bundle really encodes, it can really be seen as the phase space where the configuration space is the group G and the momentum space is always flat. Now, we want to go a bit farther than that. So we want to describe a phase space where both the configuration and momentum space are curved. So the cotangent bundle is not enough. And the way, the proper tool to encode both configuration and momentum space are curved is what I told you before. So it's this tool, this Poisson, are the Poisson Lie groups, which are a deformation of Lie group G. And the notion of phase space for this type of object is known as Heisenberg double. And this is able to encode also a curved momentum space. So the Heisenberg double is a group, and it's given by the pair, the product of G and G star, where G star is the dual of G. And we keep this group, which so that there is a mutual action between G and G star, and we keep this group with a symplectic Poisson structure, with some symplectic Poisson bracket. That's why we can really interpret it as a phase space, right? Now, obviously, if the Poisson group G is just an ordinary Lie group, then G star becomes abelian, so it becomes RD, and then the action of G star of RD on G becomes trivial, and then our Heisenberg double reduces to the cotangent bundle of G. So this is how really the generalization of the idea of a phase space for a group. Now we define the phase space of our skeletal two group, okay, as the Heisenberg double of the semi-direct product G acting on H, okay? Because as I said, we can see the skeletal two group as a semi-direct product. Now, the Heisenberg double is this expression, is given by this expression here, and you can see that we have a notion of configuration space here and momentum space. So the configuration space is the same exact product that I told you. So it's G acting on H, is this skeletal two group, whereas the momentum space is given by the dual groups. So H star acting on G star, and you can see that also the momentum space can be a semi-direct product of groups, and then is again a skeletal two groups. So we have this configuration and momentum space, which are both skeletal two groups, and there exists an action, a mutual action between them. So this is actually a full Heisenberg double with curved, or possibly curved, configuration momentum space. Now, in particular, the configuration variables are the one and two holonomies of the dual complex, so the link and the wedges. And the momentum variables are the one and two holonomies in the triangulation, so edges and faces. And you can see that here we have a natural definition of dual variables, in particular links are decorated by elements of the group G, and faces that are dual to the links are decorated by elements of the group G star. And the same is true for edges and wedges. And what I want to emphasize here is that this Heisenberg double encode the minimum amount of variables of our phase space. That's why we call it atomic phase space, and we consider it as the building block for a more general phase space. So we use many of these Heisenberg double, and we use the tool that is known as symplectic reduction to fuse them together to construct more complicated phase spaces. Now, this tool of the symplectic reduction, which we use to fuse at Heisenberg doubles, is very simple, and it's basically the fact that if you have many of these atomic free spaces, we want to glue them together, imposing some geometric constraints. Okay, obviously we impose these geometric constraints as conditions on these decorations. Okay, on these geometric decorations, and we call these conditions momentum maps. Now, as I said, we have a clear notion of duality between these decorations, and what happens when we impose these constraints is that the dual variables are glued, okay, are fused together in a single one. Now, the third aspect of the symplectic reduction is that we start from something that we understand as phase spaces, and the result is still a phase space. Okay, so this is pretty important. Now, maybe to explain this better, let's give an example, a very basic one. So we consider two atomic phase spaces, and suppose that we want to identify the links which are decorated by the elements U1 and U2. Now, this is our momentum map, U1 equal to U2, okay? And what happened is that, well, the result is given by a pair of edges and wedges, which they are independent. So we have two independent edges and two independent wedges, since we haven't imposed any conditions in them. But then we have a single link, U1 equal to U2, and dually we have a single phase decoration, which is given by the combination of beta 1 and beta 2. I'm using this symbol here just to give the idea that they have been combined together into a single variable. Now, the resulting phase space is just given by the product of the initial two, P1 and P2, where the variables of P1 and P2 are constrained to satisfy this momentum map. So this means that we take the quotient respect to the group G star, which is the group dual to the one respect to which we took the symplectic the momentum map. Okay, so we impose a condition on the variables of the group G, then we take the quotient respect to the group G star to derive the proper resulting phase space. Now, a second example, more complicated but still pretty easy, is the construction of the phase space of a triangle. In this case, we start from three atomic phase spaces, U1, 2, and 3. And obviously, a triangle is just a single phase without single dual link, right? Then, so we impose two momentum maps to identify the three links, U1 equal to U2 and U2 equal to U3. And dually, this means that the phases beta 1, beta 2, and beta 3 are combined together, are fused together into a single phase decoration. And so these first two are the first two momentum maps. The third one is imposing that the boundary of the triangle is closed. So the product of the three edges, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, is equal to 1. And now we have these three momentum maps, which are enough to describe the phase space of our triangle. So we put them together with this product. So you have two momentum maps belong to the group G, and the third momentum map belongs to the group H star. Okay, so the resulting phase space is given by the product of the initial three, where the variables again are constrained to satisfy these momentum maps. So that's why we take the quotient respect to the dual groups. Now, this is the idea. What we did is that, well, this is the first outcome of our work, is that we identified the three fundamental symplectic reductions that we used to describe any possible phase space of a triangulation T, of a three-dimensional triangulation T, with decorations on the edges and on the faces. And I remind you that the faces are flat because we are using skeletal two groups. So the first fundamental symplectic reduction is the one that we use to construct a triangle, is the one that I just told you, I just explained. Then the second one is the one that we use to construct a tetrahedron. So we take four triangles and we glue them together with some farther momentum maps. And the third one, if you want to construct a three-dimensional geometry, now we have this tetrahedra, we need to glue them together. So the third symplectic reduction is the one that we use to identify the faces. It means that we construct a full link that goes from the center of one tetrahedron to the center of the other tetrahedron. So using these three momentum maps, okay, a combination of them, we are able to construct any possible three-dimensional triangulation. This was our first outcome. Second one is the application of our construction. You can see that here we used any possible skeletal two groups. But now we can choose a specific example of skeletal two group, which is the Poincaré two group. So now in this case, we really see the configuration variables. So the links and the wedges, we decorate them as with the elements of the Poincaré group. So we decorate the links with the element of the Lorentz group and the wedges with the element of the group of translations. Whereas in the momentum space or the momentum variables, edges and faces, which are the one and two autonomous or the triangulations, are decorated by the dual groups. Okay, so R6 and R4. And you can see that both of them are flat. That means that our triangulation, so our discrete geometry, is completely flat. Now, if we do that, our construction really recovers what is already known in literature, what is introduced in this paper here, that is known as G networks, which are graphs dual to 3D triangulations where links and wedges are decorated by elements of the Poincaré groups. So we recover these objects. Now, since we dealt with a slightly more general case of two groups, we can go a bit farther than that. And we can suppose to use, instead of the Poincaré group, we can use the Kappa Poincaré group, which is a generalization of the first, which is pretty well known in many, is used in a few approaches to quantum gravity, okay? And it's basically the fact that the configuration variables, links and wedges, are still decorated by the same element, so by the elements of the Poincaré group. But now the momentum variables, so the dual group is deformed, so we decorate, again, the faces with element of R6, which is an abelian group, obviously, because the faces have to be flat because we are still using a skeletal two group. But now the edges are decorated by elements of AN3. Okay, so in this case, we have a discrete geometry with curved edges and flat faces. So we are not describing yet a curved geometry, but an hybrid one. Okay, now, third and last outcome of our project are the proper, what are like insights on what are the proper geometric conditions that we need when we want to construct a triangulations or a dual complex or phase space in general, decorated with both one and two autonomies. So, and we are going to use this insight for the next project, but I think there is a
question. Yes,
hi. Yeah, so in the Poincaré two group case, actually the title is slightly wrong. It's quantum geometry from higher gauge theory, if I remember correctly. The momenta were actually indeed momenta in the sense that you got something which you could interpret as a Hamiltonian constraint and the momenta constraint. So if you replace it in the Kappa Poincaré two group with R4 with AN3. Can you comment a bit what it means? Does it mean you have bounded energy, for instance?
This means that as far as I, from my understanding is that, yes, you might have bounded energies, or well, geometrically you interpret these edges are as carved ones. So with the curvature, which is given by the cosmological constant, the natural curvature of this group. And yes, from the spectrum.
Cosmological constant. I mean, you have this kappa. Is that kappa related to the cosmological constant?
Well, in many approaches, it might be related. Obviously, it's not a general truth. So sorry, maybe I overspoke, but yes. Well, the AN3 group depends on a constant that can be interpreted as the cosmological constant, but not necessarily. But it depends on this kappa parameter, right? And this gives the curvature of the edges. And then from the states point of view, yes, I would say that, we might have a spectrum with bounded, a bounded spectrum for bounded energies on the momentum, on our triangulations. The spectrum of the eigenvalues that we use to describe the edges is discrete in this case.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yes. It's okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, as I said, we are going to use these ideas that we derived here in this, as I said, this is a simplified case, so because we use skeletal groups. we use these outcomes to construct a generalization of a group field theory. So it's a group field theory based on two groups. And in this case, we are using general two groups. So we use the geometric insights, so the geometric ideas that we learn in this more complicated, more general case. I know that probably many of you are not even familiar with group field theory, so I just want to say one sentence on it. You can see group field theory as this is a path integral formulation of discrete geometries, and in particular, then it is given by an action that you use to construct a partition function, and then you can compute the amplitude of your partition function as usual. And these amplitudes, so these Feynman diagrams, are spin forms. Okay, so you can see group field theory as this path integral formulation that generates the spin forms. This is one way to see it, just to give an idea what it is. Now, the first ingredient to give in a group field theory is the field. In 3+1 dimension of ordinary group field theory, the field is the graph dual potetrahedron. So it means that since we are in ordinary group field theory, we are using groups, and means that the graph dual potetrahedron is just a set of the four links dual to the four faces. Okay, so U1, U2, U3, and U4. And the field is a function of them. Now, we are in a more general case. So we want to use two groups. So we decorate not only the links, but also the six wedges dual to the six edges of the tetrahedron. Then our field is a function on the four links and on the six wedges. Maybe this is not clear at this point, but for those of you who are not that familiar with two groups, but this shape is not really the shape of a function on a two group. Then how did we define the field as a function on a two group? Well, we define the field as a function on 12 copies of a two group. And why 12 copies? Well, because before I told you how to construct the phase space of a triangle, right? We started by three atomic phase spaces and we glue them together through the momentum maps. Now we want to describe a tetrahedron. So we take four triangles, that means 12 atomic phase spaces, and we glue them, we merge them with the proper momentum maps, with the proper geometric conditions. And indeed, this is what we do. So we define this field, which is the actual one, that this is the graph dual to tetrahedron, as a field, a function on 12 copies of a two group. And these two group elements are constrained to satisfy some geometric constraints such that this actually becomes the graph dual tetrahedron. And these geometric constraints are nothing more than the momentum maps that we derived in the previous project. Okay, so this is what I mean when I said we use the insights, the geometric insights that we deduced from the previous project to construct these two group field theory. Now, second ingredient is the Fourier transform. Because, before in the previous project, we were working at the level of the phase space. Here we are choosing a polarization. So we are only considering the dual complex. Now, obviously we can define the same theory also in the triangulation, okay? Where we would have a dual field that is naturally interpreted as the tetrahedron, okay? Not the graph dual to it. And so we want a map that allow us to go from the triangulation to the dual complex. And this map is called Fourier transform. Okay. And is as usual, this is given as an integral operator where the kernel is this function E that we call two plane wave. And obviously, since this is an operator that takes object from the dual complex to the triangulation and vice versa, obviously, this has to encode some information on both the two cellular decompositions. So you can see that this two-plane wave actually encode the minimum amount of information on the dual complex, so on links and wedges, but also on the triangulation, edges and faces. This is naturally interpreted as our atomic phase space that we used to have in the previous project. And then, indeed, we really define this two-plane wave as of the object whose properties encode the geometric conditions, the geometric rules of an atomic phase space. Okay, so this is the idea of the Fourier transform, and then we will see in a second how we can use it. Before that, another ingredient is the gauge transformation, and I will be very quick on that because in ordinary group field theory as well as in two group field theory, we define a gauge transformation on the variables of the dual complex, so on links and wedges. This is the two gauge transformation that we derived. And in order to implement this two gauge transformation, we define an operator P, okay, that projects the field onto the gauge transformed variables. Okay. In particular, we are going to use this two gauge transformation and this projector here together with the Fourier transform. So we compute the Fourier transform of the projected field to derive what is known as closure constraint. So as I said, the field is interpreted as the graph dual tetrahedron. The dual field then is interpreted as the graph related to a tetrahedron. This closure constraint, as the name says, gives the closure of this tetrahedron. Okay, so in ordinary group field theory, where we only decorate the faces of the tetrahedron, the closure is nothing more than the closure of the four faces of the boundary of the tetrahedron, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, beta 4. Now that we also have decoration on the edges of the tetrahedron, the closure constraint also encodes the closure of the three triangles that compose the boundary of the four triangles, that compose the boundary of the tetrahedron. So this is the closure constraint, and it's going to be very important just in a second, I will tell you. But before, let me tell you about the action. So the action of group field theory is given by two terms, an interaction term and a kinetic term. The interaction term is given by the combination of five fields, so five tetrahedra, you can imagine that. Five tetrahedra with a proper combinatoric such that the result is the boundary of a four simplex. Okay, so we have this interaction term that describes a four simplex or the graph dual to it. And the kinetic term is then the propagator of the model, which is used to glue together four simplexes. So using interaction term and kinetic terms and the proper combination of them, we can construct any possible four dimensional discrete geometries or triangulation or is dual complex. So we glue together four simplexes. Now here, the difference between ordinary group field theory and two group field theory is very little, because in two group field theory, we just have more decorations. So we also have the information on the wedges and on the edges. Then that means that the expression of the interaction term is a bit more complicated, but the idea is always the same. Okay, so we want to describe this type of triangulations and dual complexes, and in particular, I want to emphasize that, as I told you before, these amplitudes that we can construct in ordinary group field theory are spin forms. So the amplitudes of a two group field theory can be naturally interpreted as a generalization of them. So I would call them two spin forms. So there are spin forms with decorations on both links and wedges. Now, our model is a topological model, so we are not talking about gravity at this level. That means that a model of discrete geometry is topological if it is invariant under the Packner moves. So the Packner moves are transformations between topologically equivalent triangulations. So there are three Packner moves in four dimensions. We prove that the amplitude of our model are invariant under this type of transformation, so we do have a topological model, which is not, and this work is not, is not being submitted yet. It's almost done. Now, the very last thing that I want to say is that now here we are going back to the first slide. Okay, so we want to describe a Stetson model of four dimensional curved geometries. So we can include curved geometries because we are using two groups as a mathematical tool. So we have a decoration on one and two autonomies, both in the triangulation and dual complex. So we are really describing curved geometries. And we have a model that can be expressed as a state sum model. And in particular, since we have that Fourier transform, we can express this state sum either in the triangulation or in the dual complex. And in the triangulation picture, the state sum is nothing more, is just given by the proper combination of four simplex amplitudes, okay? Or rather, by the proper combination of tetrahedron amplitudes, which are these closure constraints that we derived before. So this partition function is equivalent to the one of the Yetter model, which is a state sum model, a topological state sum model of four dimensional discrete geometries based on two groups. So we recover this this model, which is the most general one that that exists in literature. Whereas in the dual complex, the states of model is very similar. It's just that since now the dual complex is not a simplicial complex, but is a can be made of any polyhedron, so not just tetrahedral for simplicity. So the state sum is just a sum over all the possible four-dimensional polyhedra. Okay, and these polyhedra, each of them it encodes the curvature around a single vertex. So this is the type of curvature that I was mentioning in the beginning, and also the curvature around all the edges that are attached to this vertex. Okay, now we expressed this state sum. Well, we express our model. We formulated our model for any two group. In particular, we can again go into the specific example of the Poincaré group. Now, in this case, the state sum, so the amplitude of our model in the dual complex, are exactly the G networks, okay, that I told you before. And then the state sum is given by the equivalent to that of the KBF model, which is a state sum model of four-dimensional geometries in the dual complex based on the representations of the Poincaré group. So in both cases, we recover what is already known in literature. Now, I want to take a few more minutes to tell you what we can do with two groups, because I haven't emphasized that enough, but two groups are really, really new objects, or rather their application to quantum gravity have not been explored enough. In particular, here I mentioned the notion of a Poisson-Le group, the notion of a quantum group or Heisenberg double, all these objects, which are very well known for group theory, well, for two groups, either they have been defined very recently, so in the last few years, or maybe we don't even have a clear definition of them, a clear theory that describes them. So some of the aspects that we really need to explore then are what is the representation theory for two groups, and in particular the Peter-Weyl theorem for them. But also, what is the concept of a quantum two group? Because, well, there have been a few proposals in literature, but they seem to do not agree on some features, on some aspects. So it's not clear whether what is actually a quantum two group. And last point, which is actually very important, is that we might need to go beyond two groups. So in this presentation, I try to convince you that two groups are a really good tool for four-dimensional quantum gravity. And well, in my opinion, they really are more useful than groups or quantum groups in four dimensions. But maybe these are not enough yet to really encode all the features of really quantum gravity. Because as I said, I stopped my presentation at the topological level, okay, at the topological model. So we didn't include the geometric constraint, so what is known as simplicity constraint. So one possible future work is definitely how we can include, well, regards how we can include the geometric constraints in our two group theory, in our discrete model. And for doing that, we might need some notion of some type of generalization of two groups. So yes, we need decorations on one and two autonomies, but are really two groups the object that we need, or maybe we need something more general, more complicated. The last thing that I want to tell you about is that I try to convince you that two groups are really good for describing four-dimensional curved geometries, but they might have another role also in quantum gravity, which is the fact that they can be used, well, two groups, but in general, higher categories, they can be used to introduce some topological defects in the theory. In particular, we can consider a 2+1 dimensional model of discrete geometries. And as I said before, one of the topological features that we want to describe is the curvature around the vertex, which is given by the one holonomy around it. Now we can describe this one holonomy, this curvature, using groups or quantum groups even. But then suppose that we want to describe it using two groups. Then what is the extra layer? What is the extra information? Well, the extra information is the decoration on these wedges, which are internal to this one holonomy. Okay. And you can really see that this wedge is dual somehow to this vertex. So the new degrees of freedom, the extra degrees of freedom that we are introducing, can really be interpreted as the internal degrees of freedom of this vertex. So we really have control, or at least one interpretation of it. Obviously, this is not a work that is clear, but one interpretation of that might be that we have control on the internal degrees of freedom of this vertex. So we can really describe the spectrum of it, and maybe the spectrum of it can be interpreted as the spectrum either as a topological, as a point-like topological defect, or maybe as the spectrum of a point-like particle placed in this vertex. And maybe we can, using different type of two groups, we can actually include the degrees of freedom of a bosonic or a fermionic particle, or maybe something more complicated. I don't know, because this is not done yet. Obviously, we can do a similar exercise also in four dimensions, in 3+1 dimensions, where in this case, we would need to use three groups, which are the generalization of a two group, which are a bit more complicated, but then they might cover the same role for four-dimensional geometries. And that's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Matteo, for this very nice talk. Okay, are there questions first from students? I do not see questions from students for now, but I see a question by Bianca.
Thanks for this nice talk. I have a question first to the GFT part. Typically, yeah, it's required we have a compact group to define all the integrations, but you had examples where you had at least non-compact factors like H. How do you deal with that?
So you mean that in GFT, we normally have some divergences coming from the volumes of the group? This is what you mean, or?
No, yeah, well, usually, you know, they're defined for something like SU2, and we use the Haar measure on that. And so it's kind of at least finite if you consider a few variables. But now you consider something where the group itself or the two group itself is non-compact.
Yes, yes. Yeah, obviously we face this trouble, this issue in the definition of the model, and the solution that we have been that we propose is that we need to regularize obviously the amplitudes generated by this model, and regularize, I mean, we really regularize them by n, so we divide by some volumes, and eventually we can, for instance, we can define the elements, so we can consider like this function, so the field, as a function with a finite support on a non-compact group, so that the volume of the non-compact group is still finite, and then we get a finite volume. These are the divergences that you mentioned, and in this case we can regularize it just by dividing by this volume. I know this is a very handmade regularization, but this is the best that we have been able to do. Yeah, so just okay. An main regularization.
And another question, if I may. So that applies to both the phase-based construction and the GFT, and this maybe, you know, my favorite subject in this context is around the edge simplicity constraints. So are these part of the things you do during your symplectic reduction? That is kind of the first question to the phase space. And do they in any way show up in your GFT construction? It might not be the case. I mean, you claim you get the KBF model, which is in terms of the representation data. But we have seen that only kind of needed to discuss if we actually explicitly go to the representation data. So the first question is, do these appear at all in your symplectic deduction construction.
The simplicity constraint.
The edge, what in this paper is called the edge simplicity constraints, which.
Yeah, is the flatness around an edge, right?
It's not said explicitly. It's if you parallel transport the edge itself, around the edge, you do get back to the edge.
Yes. Well, we do have something like that in maybe in group field theory. I don't know, maybe we might have something like that, but this is much more clear in this construction of the phase space. Because yes, using basically these symplectic reductions, we can really construct the phase space of a closed holonomy, so of a path dual to an edge. And doing so, you can really see that if you parallel transport an object around this edge, then you really recover the object itself, so the initial object, so which is, as for my understanding, was something very similar to what you called edge simplicity in this paper here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so we recover something like that, yes. Mm-hmm. I initially mentioned it in the slide. I just took it away because here I wanted to mention only the fundamental symplectic reductions. Mm-hmm. So that is a result, a combination of some of them. So mm-hmm. that's why I didn't mention it. But yes.
Are there other questions? Sat.
Hello, Matthew.
Hey,
how are you?
Good to see you.
Yes, nice to see you too. I have a question about your motivation. You started off with GR is can be written as a BF plus some constraints, but then you went to two group like BFCG and stuff. So my question is. Is going to the hair gauge theory, is it just for like the discretization purposes? Or because still at the end of the day, GR is still BF, not BFCG or anything like that. It's still a BF plus constraints. You know what I mean? So it's like, is it just for discretization purposes, and then do you hope to come back to BF or just keep going higher?
Well, first of all, maybe I should introduce what are BF CG models. I actually have a backup slide for that. But as you can imagine, a BF CG model is nothing more than a generalization of BF models. So it's a topological model. Which is defined as the classical action that upon discretization gives the actual model. Okay, so the model that I mentioned before, this is for everyone. Now, first of all, I want to say that actually a BF model can be seen as a BFCG model based on skeletal two groups, and I can show you that in a second. So, on one side, you're right. We introduced two groups because we were really motivated by the discrete picture. So we really wanted to have some carved faces, some carved geometries, and we realized that we need to have some extra information, some extra degrees of freedom, in particular the one on the edges on the metric, also for dimension to include these curved geometries. So first, I would say yes. First argument comes from the discrete level, but also at the classical level, you can really see. A BF theory, as I said, as a BFCG theory based on skeletal two groups. And here I provide an example, a very nice example, which is for a BF theory, which is based on a SO n plus one valued one form connection. So this is the gauge group that we consider. This is the algebra of the gauge group that we consider for this BF theory. And in this case, what we do is to split the connection. This is Carly A into a pair of connections. So we basically use the Agasawa decomposition for this group. So they connect the smaller connection A is an SO N1 valid one form, and the connection E is going to be an ANM valid one form. And we do the same with the B field. So we split it in a small B and sigma, okay? At this point, so we start from this action, okay? And when we split it, it becomes something like that, okay? Where now F is the usual, well, it's not the usual, but is the curvature respect to the connection A, whereas T here is the torsion, so is the curvature respect to this other connection E that is going to be interpreted as the triad, obviously. Now, what we do here is known as semi-dualization. So you integrate by part this sigma T sector, okay, because T is the covariant derivative respect to E. So we integrate by part and we get this model. So you can see that these first two terms are exactly of the shape of a BFCG model. Maybe I haven't spent too much time on it, but this is like BFCG, where C is a one form and G is the curvature respect to a two form sigma. Okay, and here we have exactly that. So we have E, which is the C field as a one form, and here we have G sigma from the, because we move the covariant derivative from T to sigma here. Now, at the classical level, you can really see that this initial BF model is exactly the same of the final BFCG model, okay? They are totally the same because the only difference is this boundary term. And a boundary term is irrelevant at the classical level. But at a discrete level, they are different theories because since we have a farther boundary term, the symplectic potential now is different. That means that we have a different interpretation for the phase space. Okay, so initially we used to have if we discretize this BF model, we would have ended up with a phase space given by the cotangent bundle of the initial group. So SO n plus 1, 1, which is where the configuration space can be interpreted as this group and the momentum space is flat. Okay, so this is what we usually do in BF theory. But now, since we have a BFCG theory and since we apply this semi-dualization, basically we moved some configuration variable into momentum space and some momentum variables into the configuration space. So we did this partial splitting, okay? And we ended up with a configuration space, which is given by this, this is the generalized Poincaré group, as you can see, as a configuration space. And the momentum space instead is the dual of it. So this is really the generalized version of the kappa Poincaré two group, okay? And here we ended up with an Eisenberg double. So for replying to your question, at the classical level, there is no difference between them, between a BF theory and a skeletal and a BFCG theory based on a skeletal two group, because you can see here that we are dealing with something, we end up with an Eisenberg double of a skeletal two group, okay, not of a general two group, because we have an abelian group here and an abelian group here. But then at the discrete level, they are really different. So the discrete level is our main motivation. Thank you for the question. I was hoping for that.
Okay.
I see one more question by Bianca.
Yes.
Since this construction is a kappa Poincaré two group came up again, can you comment more on potential application, in particular with this kappa Poincaré group?
Application of the kappa Poincaré group itself or group field theory?
Of your construction, for instance, for quantum gravity. I mean, could that be, you know, do you think one needs to use this construction to obtain a kappa Poincaré symmetry and the limit to flat geometries? I think there was a proposal that it already comes out of loop quantum gravity, but does it make that more explicit? Or does one need to use that if one wants to encode kappa Poincaré symmetry instead of just Poincaré symmetry?
So I would say that basically maybe the most interesting feature of this kappa Poincaré at the place of Poincaré is that obviously, we have a curved decoration on the edges, so a non-abelian decoration on the edges. That means, for instance, in LQG, if you consider the one holonomy around a triangle, so this is the one Gauss, right? If I'm not mistaken. So this is you can see, for instance, at the spectrum of the energy of this one Gauss, and this is going to be discrete. So this is probably one of the main new features that you include in the model if you use kappa Poincaré. So if you use this type of deformation.
Isn't that the two Gauss?
It's known as two Gauss, yes. It's the closure of a triangle, yes. It's two Gauss. But yes, so you have a discrete spectrum on that. And this is probably from the quantum level perspective. And from the just the geometry perspective, as I said before, we have curved edges. And I, honestly, I didn't want to mention that because I'm definitely not an expert on that.
The discrete spectrum would be for the R6 variables, no? No, are you saying that SO3-1 is conjugated to AN3?
No. SO3-1 is conjugated to R6.
So the discrete spectrum is for the R4 variables on.
You're right. We would have a discrete spectrum on the wedges. Yes, on the
on faces. Okay.
Yes. Sorry. Yes. So which is the two holonomy? Yes. The discrete
the
spectrum.
The two holonomies. Okay.
Yes.
And I think if I remember correctly, these would be indeed kind of, okay, can you remind me, are these the tetrads or are these the momenta conjugated to the tetrads?
So these edges, my interpretation is that these edges are tetrads or triads, tetrads. Whereas the wedges here, this element of R4, are the momenta conjugated to the tetrads. Yes.
Yeah. So these would be indeed related to the Hamiltonians, kind of.
Yes. Yes.
And these would have discrete spectrum.
Yes. So in that indeed, the discrete spectrum. Yes. It's on the energy, on the energy level. Yes. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't have many other hints for justifying the use of kappa Poincaré, but I think. Might be enough. What do you think?
Well, it would be interesting to know if one could define quantum geometry or quantum gravity based on that.
Yeah. For instance, if I can add something more, I said that we don't have a clear definition, we don't have a classification of the representation for two groups, but we do have a definition of representation for skeletal two groups. And well, here, the dual of the kappa Poincaré group is still a skeletal two group. So in principle, we could define the representation of this two group here. So that would be,
the first thing you could do is to define the equivalent of the KBF model. No?
Yeah.
Okay, that would be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there more questions or comments? Okay, so if not, I see one. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Matteo, for this very, very nice talk. So can you go back to the triangle phase space slide? Let me think. So I think there is lambda 1, 2, 3. Lambda is an H.
Lambda 1, 2, 3 is an element of the group H star. I can just go back off to here. So this is the configuration space, link and wedge. This is the momentum space, edge and phase. Yes.
Okay. Because in the there are these just two gauge TQFTs where I think here the geometric constraints for gluing into a triangle phase space, I think there is a way to deform the constraints, right, using an associator instead of putting it to be just one. So there's an associator that takes three elements of G, or the one holonomy variables in whichever selector that you want, and then it sends to, well, it's the associator, right? So it takes lambda one bracket lambda two lambda three, and it sends it to lambda two lambda one lambda two bracket lambda three, and that is an element in the two holonomies. So
okay,
yeah,
I see. I mean, I'm not sure. I correct me if I misunderstood. Can we see like this correction, this associator, as the T-map of the phase, or maybe you're talking about something more general? Because I think you're talking about two categories which are not associative.
Yes. Yeah. So the objects are not associative, I should say.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, honestly, I don't know very well these kinds of two categories. I mean, I know very well that you are much more expert than me on that. So I don't know. I've been working on some sort of generalization of two groups, and I try to find what is possibly the generalization of a two group also for non-associative two categories. So how we can see this type of two category that naturally encode the notion of one and two holonomies. Also also when the elements are non-associative, so we really need these associators. But I didn't go very far in this construction, this computation. So I honestly don't know what this notion that you are mentioning. So would rather prefer to don't comment too much on that.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, because like. I, from my reading in condensed matter, I noticed that they always pick these, this general associator, the three cocycle, and then they assign it to sort of like, you know how you, it's very similar to this triangle phase space where they decorate essentially domain walls with codimension one and codimension two domain walls. And the associators are assigned to the junctions exactly in this picture. So,
okay.
Yeah, at least topologically speaking, I think, for example, in the Yetter model, that's where I've seen like these associators pop up. But yeah, this interpretation in terms of the phase space, triangle phase space, is new to me. And it seems that there's a relationship, I think.
But aren't they using a weak two categories? And here we are only focusing on strict two categories. So I think the associator and that thing that arise when you're dealing with a weak two categories.
Is that? Yeah.
It might be the case. So here we are only working on the simpler case of strict two categories.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, since we are running out of time, I would suggest that we close here the discussion, and let's thank Matteo again for his talk and discussion.
Thank you so much.